Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis. Two ex-SAS guys armed with MBAs, seeking out people who are leading lives less ordinary in order to find out how they fill their unforgiving minutes and what helps them go always a little further.
Welcome to part B of Leadership as a Contact Sport. However, in order to progress past this point, you really should be able to tell us the difference between rainforests and fighter jets and the applicability to leadership. And what about the acronym MBWA? Can you tell me what it is and why it's important? If the answers are no and no, then back up, go and listen to part A. If your answers are yes, well, enjoy the show.
So you've been a tactical commander during counter-terrorism assaults. Mm-hmm. Once the fight starts, how much can you truly lead?
Your sphere of influence is greatly reduced.
Your sphere of interest is high and wide.
My sphere of interest is high, yeah, exactly. But, people have generally got more pressing imperatives than listening to your wonderful leadership tips over the radio.
That's true. And once I do remember doing a counter-terrorist attack, it was a special recovery assault where you turned your radio off on me.
I'm sure I ran out of batteries. Your top tips were very welcome, but just not at that point in time. It speaks to that point that people are preoccupied, and this is where that plan is nothing, planning is everything. The idea that you have gotten the whole team on that same mental model so that when, not if, when things change, when the situation takes a complete 180 degree turn, they've got an idea of what success looks like. They've got a really clear understanding of your intent, and they're able to make their own decisions in accordance with that in the heat of the moment. They can react to unexpected occurrences, or they can seize fleeting opportunities, which may mean that you don't actually need to do the plan at all. If your mission is to get the bad guy, and you know you think you're going to need to kick in the door and clear the house, but the bad guy's in the backyard doing some gardening when you rock up, then you can obviously grab him without going through the task as you'd planned it.
And it's not unique, is it, to the military? We see it on the soccer field, the football field, the rugby field, where there's no one leader out there. They just change formation and do different things the way that they communally read the play, which is interesting. And we also see it a lot in nature. We see it in bees with the way that they swarm.
Yep.
We see it in fish. We see it in birds. And it's prompted actually this whole concept of swarm leadership, which Harvard and Cambridge, incidentally, have now are now talking about, which is a phenomenon in which no one is in charge. It's not quite that free reign, but yet all leaders follow the same principles and rules. Now, in a different podcast, we're going to talk about intent and mission command, because I think swarm leadership doesn't work without understanding intent and the mission command principle. And please tune back in for intent and mission command. But in doing that, the idea behind swarm leadership is that the group of people, whether it's the counter-terrorist assaulters or the footballers, the rugby players or the bees, are able to accomplish more together than any one leader could alone. And their five principles that's now been articulated are unity of mission. Again, the understanding intent and mission command. Yep. The second one, more colloquially, is staying in your lane, so understanding your role in that mission. The third one, which is quite interesting, is not having an ego and the no-blame environment. So if indeed something didn't go exactly to script but you used your initiative, then that's okay. And the fourth being a generosity of spirit and action. So people have to seize that initiative. And the last one is the trust-based component. And I actually think trust is a huge dividend when it comes to leadership. Building that bank of trust wins you a lot of merit.
And it's, again, you know, without wanting to hark on the leadership as a contact sport thing, it's very hard to do that just via email. You know, the idea of getting down and having a brew in the Q store, as you mentioned before, is really a key part of developing that trust.
Servant leadership. Different concept. The title is somewhat misleading.
Yeah.
Did you want to talk a little bit about servant leadership?
I think this does talk to that two-way relationship between a leader and followers, and there's a whole bunch of these, I guess, variations on this kind of thing, things like path goal theory, where the leadership's the leader's role is to define the goal and then clear the obstacles for the followers to achieve the path. I think this does link back into that humility and the human element of leadership, that leadership is not about self-aggrandizement. It's not about your own personal goals. It's about the organizational goals. And if you truly believe in that, then fundamentally you can't do that without a commitment to helping the people who are working underneath you. And so the idea of servant leadership as linked to that human concept, being able to form a relationship, understand strengths and weaknesses of your team, and then assist them not only in achieving the goal but in self-development, I think is really critical to a more mature sort of leader.
And not a new concept. I think in the 1970s was Robert Greenleaf, I understand, wrote The Servant as a Leader. So that's been around for some 50 years, where the leader puts the needs of employees and the organisation first.
Yeah. And I think the idea of sharing power, and it comes back to this concept of humility and ego, that, you know, if you're one of these leaders who feels that you can't be challenged, that you need to have all the answers all the time, and that you know, you're that central point for everything. I think it just sounds exhausting, but yeah. B, it's quite toxic. People don't respond well to that, and I think it's very hard for organisations to thrive under that kind of leadership. By sharing that power, by delegating appropriately, giving people the opportunity to develop their own leadership within your clearly defined intent, and not just firing and forgetting, you know, leading by walking around, asking those difficult questions, getting that feedback loop going, then that is a really strong recipe for an effective organisation.
And the antithesis of that autocratic or authoritarian style, this was more about the people not working to serve the leader, but rather the leader existing to serve the people. Another thing that I'm really interested in is this intergenerational leadership. You know, we're now in this workforce where we've got the baby boomers, people born in the 15 odd years leading up to the 1960s, the Generation X's, so people born between 1960 and 1980s, Generation Y, often called the Millennials, 1980 to 2000, and now Generation Z, which I think is also referred to as the I generation. Now, each of those generations we can stereotype, and we won't do that right now, but what's the secret to leading across generations, intergenerational leadership?
I think we've always, certainly in the last century, we've always seen this friction where the leadership paradigms that we grew up with as a generation of mid to senior leaders are changing each time. And you look at the 60s was a classic example, you know, that friction as Vietnam War and all the sort of catalytic events in the 60s were changing society, and the baby boomers and sort of World War II sort of era leaders were having dramas coming to terms with it. So I think this is part of this idea of complexity, that the world is constantly changing and we need to adapt, and we can't just have this idea of methodism. A guy called Dietrich Dorner wrote an incredibly interesting book called The Logic of Failure, where he talks about methodism, and that's the unthinking application of a previously successful method of achieving a goal. And you know, if we keep rolling out what used to work and expecting it to continue working, we're setting ourselves up for failure. So A, we need to remain adaptive to the environment. We need to understand that, you know, kids of today, as greybeards like yourself and I would refer to them, are not going to respond in the same way that we did, and are not going to necessarily be inspired by the same sort of leadership. So that's an important part. But the second part is that, and particularly I think now, you know, where we've got this whole generation of digital natives, we should be harnessing them, you know, particularly in consumer, you know, customer facing sort of roles, because that's a large part of the emerging demographic, and it's very difficult for older leaders to engage in exactly the same way. So obviously we can be using a lot of those ideas, and we can only get those ideas if we create an environment where there's feedback loops and we create an environment where it is safe to express an opinion, where it's safe to challenge the plan, where it's safe to throw different or contrarian ideas out there in a planning sense.
And personal growth, I mean, again, a little story from running one of the businesses in Dubai, and the year was, I think, around 2009. And I had a member of staff who we'll call Michael, and we'd sat down as a management team and we'd agreed a set of priorities looking forward, and he was assigned priority number one. Mm-hmm. And a week later, I went and saw Michael, who was a millennial, Gen Y, without stereotyping, of course. And I said, Michael, how are we going on priority number one? And he said, I don't like priority one, number one. So I'm working on priority number five, because that's cool. I really like priority number five. So I'm going to give that a bit more effort than priority number one. Mm. Now, after, I guess, a first career in uniform, and then I came out during, to the UN, I thought, well, that's a bit odd. He should just kind of do what he's told.
Yeah.
And I said, but priority number one, that is the thing that we are supposed to be giving main effort to. He goes, no, I don't like it. Priority number five. That's what I'm working on. Now, I often reflect on that, and I've realised that that was a great learning experience for me.
Yeah.
And certainly the way, and probably a dawning realisation of my inability as a leader to lead across generations, because I just didn't quite understand them. Mm. And also speaking with my son, who is in that iGen, born exactly 2001, and their opinions, of which they have many on everything, are quite profound, and the information age is propelling that.
I was going to say, and actually pretty well informed in a lot of cases. I mean, it's easy to say you're a 17-year-old punk, what would you know? But again, we're using our paradigm, because when I was 17, the internet didn't exist. And so what I knew was the sum total of a couple of half-read books from the sort of high school library. Mm. Whereas, you know, there is a lot more worldliness, and certainly that's one thing that struck me. That you do see just that I guess sophistication of knowledge coming on at a much earlier stage.
It's funny, you know, I think my son was probably 12 when he asked me the question, tell me about the geopolitics in the Middle East.
Yeah, right.
What's going on in Iraq and Syria and all of that interplay. He didn't use that word. But, you know, clearly their global view is far more sophisticated than ours ever was back when we were growing up. Okay, I think we've got two things left to do. Mm-hmm. The first thing one, is questions from listeners. Yeah. And we love hearing from our listeners, and you can get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. So we had a question from Grant on differing leadership styles. So is there differing leadership styles where leadership is a necessity versus leadership is a choice? So for example, aspiring to be a CEO because you want to lead versus needing to lead in order to achieve a mission. And there's a linked supplementary question there about leadership under obligation, and the example that he uses is the royal family.
Yeah, interesting question. Thanks, Grant. I reckon that the crux of this is that environmental concept, so understanding the different environments. The leadership in order to achieve a mission, I mean, at its very simplest, you could imagine a chaotic environment, and the one that I think summarises this perfectly would be 9/11. You know, you're going to work in New York City, and no one's even thought about the idea of flying a plane into it. It's just complete black swan. And then all of a sudden the towers start falling, and your very safe, ordered environment has completely been flipped on its head. I reckon that is a great example of, you know, requiring leadership to achieve a mission.
Yeah. And swarm leadership. We saw a lot of that, including in the attacks in the US Boston bombing, London, Paris, where there was no direction specifically given to anyone.
That's right.
But swarm leadership took over and sought to resolve the problem.
And look, the mission is pretty clear. You know, we need to get people out. We don't know what's happening, and it's continuously evolving. We need to remain open to the idea that building may collapse or whatever. There may still be shooters out there. But we need to get these hurt people to safety. We need to try and get the casualties looked after. And so, yeah, I think that when it's sort of thrust upon you, and I think they're very interesting environments, and you certainly see it in the military, we get good training, outstanding training, both in leadership and tactics and, you know, weapon handling and all that sort of stuff. But that crucible moment when you're in your first firefight, that really does sort of, I guess, act as the litmus test for that particular kind of leadership to achieve a mission, that almost life and death sort of style. Whereas leading because you want to lead, I reckon that's an interesting way of phrasing that question. I think it brings out a couple of interesting points, and that's the idea, you know, that you want to be a CEO because you want to lead. And I think if that's truly the case, then you're set up for success. If you want to lead in all these ways that we've been talking about, this servant leadership, bettering the organisation, achieving the mission, then that's a really good foundation for being a leader. If, however, you want to be a CEO or a leader because you like what it looks like on a business card...
And ego is not your amigo.
Ego is not your amigo.
A great philosopher said that.
Yeah, yeah.
Mark Wahlberg, I think, in the recent movie...
22
miles. Could be 20 miles. Might have put an extra two on there, somewhere around that. Like
we always go a little further in this podcast. So 23 and a half miles. ego is not your amigo. There's probably a whole episode in ego and the pros and cons of ego in leadership in there somewhere. But, yeah, I think if you're doing it for the right reasons, then, yes, that is a really noble pursuit. If you're doing it for your own ends, then it's probably more difficult to pull off effective leadership.
And that's probably a nice little segue into the supplementary question, which was leadership because you're obliged, like Grant's example of the royal family.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of any other examples, you know, like that's a particularly almost unique case. I reckon that'd be terribly difficult. And you see people sort of throughout history buckling against this expectation. I reckon that'd be tough.
Mm. Second question, Simon from Kentucky in the US, and you do like your Kentucky.
They produce some good libations.
This is an interesting concept on micro leadership. So what's your advice for micro leadership? For example, leadership for the little guy, so not the CEO, could be the rugby club coach or the surf club person, might be a young entrepreneur or a busy family person with little time to spare.
I don't reckon, you know, we're talking about differences of scale, not of kind. I think we're exactly the same concepts, the same principles that we've discussed today. So having a clear intent, being able to communicate that in a manner that resonates and inspires with your audience. Now, as I'm saying this, I'm thinking about my complete inability to lead my 7 and 10-year-old children. So I'm obviously failing in that respect.
Good intergenerational leadership.
Bad intergenerational leadership on my part. But it's exactly the same concept. So you do need to be very clear in what you're trying to achieve. You need to be clear in articulating what everyone's role is. You actually need to accept feedback. To the intergenerational point, you need to understand that it's not like when you were a kid, that you just did what you were told, that you know, it is a different environment. And you need to be constantly having that feedback loop and remaining adaptive to changes in the environment and the agents within it, which are, in my case at home, 7 and 10-year-old terrorists.
Yeah, leading family, that's an interesting concept in itself. And for all of those parents that do get frustrated by the one-word answers from the 17-year-old lying on the lounge, I would encourage you to use those tactical questioning techniques, the who, what, when, where, why. Start your questions with that, and you tend to get a different response. I've experimented, put my little 17-year-old or my big 17-year-old in a test tube, and it actually doesn't work that badly.
You haven't had to revert to waterboarding? You haven't gone that far in the tactical question?
Well, he's a little bigger than me, I've got to be careful about that. Now, so that's debrief@unforgiving60.com. Please do give us some feedback, ask any questions, or if you have some ideas of guests that could appear on the show, or anything that you might want us to research and talk about, themes you want to explore, I like that, please get in touch. Now, I said we had two things left to do.
Yeah.
The second thing is key takeaways from this podcast on leadership and all things inside it. What would be your couple of practical recommendations by way of summary?
You want two?
Sure.
Communication.
You can give me three if you really want.
I won't. I will deliver. I will not over-deliver.
As told, as directed.
As directed. Get better at communication. Things like public speaking techniques. Look up Charismatic Leadership Tactics. There's a great HBR article on it, Harvard Business Review article. These are tangible things. They actually work, and I think they can contribute to your effectiveness as a leadership. The second thing is that two-way planning, formal ritualized dissent, devil's advocacy. Driving fear from the room is what I'm talking about here, making it a safe place for everyone in the organisation to be able to give their feedback in a frank and honest manner.
In a no-blame environment.
100%.
Yep. And I've only got one, because mine are generally twice as good as yours. And this one costs you nothing. Try the management by walking around, or management by wandering around MBWA, and get to the floors and ask some questions, and you will get some interesting feedback, and often feedback that is a little out of the ordinary, somewhat unconventional, but often very valuable. And it'll be different feedback often than you're getting from your direct line managers. Okay, so I think that's all we have time for on this particular episode. In the next episode, do we have a guest?
I am pumped for this one. This is a good one.
Very good one. So Tim Robertson, former fighter pilot, got bored with that, did special operations selection, saw service in Afghanistan and in the western deserts of Iraq, got bored with that, consulted into the UN, got bored with that, was then an advisor to an oil company in Geneva, moved on from that, raised a sensitive national aviation capability, moved on from that, started his own aviation company, moved on from that, now back flying fighter jets. Now, if that's not a chronic overachiever, I don't know what is, and we might actually call the episode Tim Robertson, Chronic Overachiever.
Overachiever. No, it'll be great. A good chat with Robbo coming up.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, thanks, everyone. Thanks for sharing your time. And we do hope that you can fill your unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run. See you next time.
Ciao. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's it. Now to the debrief. Here at the Unforgiving 60, we relentlessly pursue excellence, and so we'd love to get your feedback, any insights you might have, any reflections on what we've discussed. Certainly, if you are or if you know someone who's living a life less ordinary, we'd certainly love to hear from them as well. You can get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's unforgiving60.com. Of course, you can also follow us on social media. Just search up Unforgiving60, that's 60, on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and give us a like on iTunes. Until next time we talk, we wish you all the best, and we certainly hope that what we've discussed can help you feel your own unforgiving 60s with some quality distance run. Cheers. All you businessmen.